The problem is when you say things inadvertently, right? Like you said to your wife.
Start your day the ferry way in northwest London, Wednesday, 26th of Nisan, 27th of April, 11th day of the Omer, Rabbi Moshe Friedman Shlita, Ayin Tov, and the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. This week's Torah Way has been sponsored by family David Levy on the yard side of his late father, Rabbi Shaul ben Rabbi Yisrael Levy, Zichron Levrocha, whose yard side is today.
Okay, good morning, Rabbi Yisrael. It's an honor to be here. My name is Moshe Friedman. You can tell from the accent, originally from New York, but I've been here for 5 years, so I know how to drive on the left side of the road already. I'm slowly getting acclimated. So we find ourselves in the period of the Omer, in which the Gemara in Yevamos tells us that during this time, 24,000 of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim all died. And in the Nusach of the Gemara, it says, because they weren't noheg kavod zeh lazeh. But if you go to the Medrash Rabbah in Bereishis, it actually gives a slightly different Nusach, slightly different explanation for why all of the Talmidim died. And the Nusach is, She'enehem tsara elu be'elu. Their eyes were tsar, were narrow towards each other. Now the Mepharshim on the Bereishis Rabbah explain what that means is that they hated each other, and more specifically, that they didn't help each other in learning. This one had a nice pshat, the other one was looking for had a good kasha, but he didn't help his friend with the kasha, because he said, look, this is my chiddush, I don't want you to know my Torah. And as a result of that, they all died. Now we can ask ourselves, okay, for a person to withhold his good pshat, certainly not a good midah. The idea of ayin, of a tsaris ayin, is certainly something that we don't want to espouse. But that's the reason why they all died, why they all perished. There has to be some reason, some explanation why there was a midah keneged midah here, that it would warrant death for every single Talmud of Rebbe Akiva. And in order to understand the refuah, we have to really understand the makkah. What was tsaris ayin? So the Mepharshim say, okay, they hated each other. But the Medrash doesn't say that they hated each other.
In the Yiddish, we say forgiven.
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 Okay, you'll have to help me out. What's the Yiddish? How would you explain?
To be happy with someone else's success.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's amazing, right? The Ramban in V'ahavta Rechah Kamocha says, you know, Kamocha Mamish, no, it can't be, because, you know, if I have a ketone mayim in the desert, and, you know, I can't give it to you, so I can't actually love you like I love myself. So I have to try to want for you as much as I want for myself. And that's a fantastic thing. But if I don't do that, I'm chayav misa. So there has to be an understanding here. And seemingly, the Medrash isn't telling us this for our health. It's not telling us this because it's a nice misa. It's telling us this because there's something that we're meant to be working on during this time. During Sfiras HaOmer, during the time when all of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva perished, so we should say, okay, so what is Tsaras Ayin? And do I have some shemitz at the Midah that I can try to figure out what it is and potentially work on it myself? And that we as Klal Yisrael can try to work on the Tikkun together. So let's try to understand what is an Ayin. What is an Ayin Tov? What is an Ayin Ra? And through that, we may be able to come to an understanding of why it was that the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva deserved such a great punishment. So, in order to understand this, we have to try to approach the sense of sight, but from a conceptual point of view. So what do I mean? So if I were to ask you, what is unique to the sense of seeing more than any other sense? Hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So Rav Aaron Lopiansky of the Yeshiva of Greater Washington had a very beautiful idea. Okay, he explains it like this. He says, when I see something, the way in which I interact with something that I see is entirely different from the way that I interact with something that I hear. For example, when I see a painting, the way that I interact with it is that I instantaneously process millions of bits of information all at once. I take the colors of the purple of the sunset and the green of the grass and the brown of the mountain, and my brain puts them together and connects them instantly, instantaneously. Now, compare this with the perception of hearing. When I hear something, it's through time. I gain bits of information one after another in sequence, and then only at the end of the sentence or the end of the song do I fully understand the beginning. I can't understand the entire thing until I've gotten to the end. There's a totally different quality to seeing something as opposed to hearing something. Seeing something is connecting all of the dots instantly. Hearing something is taking one linear sequence after another and being able to understand it only at the end of the sentence. The concept of sight, the quality of sight, is that it gives me a tremendous amount of information all at once, which is why the Mefarshim say that seeing is really the sense that is most greatly equated to chachma, to knowledge. Right? When it says v'tivka chena enehem, ene shnehem, by Adam and Chava, Rashi says, we're talking about knowing. We're talking about chachma. We're not speaking literally that their eyes were open, but metaphorically, when your eyes are open, what that means is you understand something better. Okay? So the positive quality of sight is that I really do get a tremendous amount of information. And of course, we say a picture is worth 1,000 words. But there is a prejudice of the eye. There is a negative quality of the eye as well. And its strength is also its weakness, which is that I gain so much information from the eye that I think I have the entire picture instantaneously. Right? And this, is, I think, is beautifully juxtaposed because we have two sayings, two aphorisms in English. One is a picture is worth 1,000 words, and another is don't judge a book by its cover. So which one's true? I mean, on the one hand, we say that seeing gives you a plethora of information. On the other hand, we say seeing can really deceive you. I remember from the Second Intifada, I think it was around 2002, 2003, when there was a famous photograph in the New York Times of an Israeli soldier standing menacingly over a young bleeding man. And the caption says, you know, Israeli soldier threatens Palestinian youth. And of course, it comes out a couple days later that it wasn't a Palestinian youth. It was a young yeshiva guy who had been, they had been throwing rocks at this man, and his face was bleeding. The soldier was protecting this man. But of course, all you see is the photograph. You don't see what's outside of it. So you think, I know what's going on. I know the story. So we have to be very, very careful that when we use our eyes tell us that we have the entire picture, and in reality, it may not be so. There is a way of using the eyes that tells us that there's something deeper. It's not just using the ayin, it's using iyun. Iyun means to look deeper. And so we have to figure out what is the process that we are able to arrive at an ayin tov, something that gives us the full picture as opposed to a false sense of understanding when we take a look at something. So what is ayin tov? What is the deeper picture that we're trying to achieve? There are essentially three definitions of an ayin tov brought in the Mefarshim. First one, Rashi on Avos says that an ayin tov simply means that you don't have kina for your friend, right? That their kavod is as important to you as your own. What your success is, I'm entirely proud of it and it doesn't threaten me at all. The deeper understanding, according to that pshat, is ayin tov means that I look at you and I say, what you have is not shayach to me. What you have has nothing to do with me, it doesn't impinge on me, it doesn't threaten me. And so I should be able to look at your success and be able to say, ah, Baruch Hashem, Yaakov made it. Yeah? So if we plug that into the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, we'd say, look, these people were jealous. They said, I don't want you to succeed, because then that means that I have a smaller slice of the pie. Second pshat, the Rambam says on the same Mishnah in Avos, I think it's the fifth parak, that it talks about the Talmidim of Avram Avidu, have an ayin tov. The Rambam famously says, what's an ayin tov? Histapkus. Now, the Rosh Yeshiva of Lakewood, founder of Lakewood, Rav Aaron Cutler, thank you, just escaped me. Rav Aaron Cutler explains in Mishnas Rabbi Aaron that the Rambam is telling us the deeper pshat of Rashi's pshat. How do I have no kina for you? Is if I have a stopkus. If I realize that everything I have is everything that I need, then whatever you get doesn't threaten me at all. If you want to work on not having kina, the Rambam says, work on histopkus. And histopkus is going to be the ultimate understanding of what an ayin tov is. And so an ayin tov is not looking outwards at you, it's looking inwards at what I have. I train my eye on my slice of the pie and I say, this is exactly what I'm meant to have and no more. And therefore your success doesn't threaten me. And so if you're ahead of me in the class, right, in the shir of Rabbi Akiva, who cares? That has nothing to do with me. We're not competing. Okay, second definition. Now the third definition is espoused actually by many of the Rishonim, as well as the Maharal. And the third definition is the Lashon of Nedivus. And Ayin Tov, it's not enough just to say that I have no kina. It's not enough just to say that I'm happy with what I've got. And Ayin Tov actually requires one step greater. And Ayin Tov requires that not only do I not have jealousy for you, but I want the greatest for you. I want the greatness for you. The Maharal explains it like this. He says, what's the difference between a Lev Tov and an Ayin Tov? And a Lev Tov means that I want what's good for you. I'm happy at your success. But an Ayin Tov means I'm looking at you. I'm looking at your chisronos. I'm looking to see how I can be mashlim your chisronos. How can I add to what you have? It's not just enough to want the good for you. But I'm actively desiring and trying to seek the good for you. I'm giving to you in a greater way. That's an Ayin Tov. And this is understood by the only place in Tanakh that we see the language of an Ayin Tov. And that is in Mishle. It says, Tov Ayin Hu Yevurach, Ki Nasan Milachmo Ladal. A Tov Ayin, one who is good of Ayin, is blessed because he gave from his bread to a poor person. Now we have to understand this because it doesn't immediately make sense why the act of nedivus is fundamentally related to having a good eye. We said the eye is there for seeing the bigger picture. That's fantastic. So maybe an ayin tov is somebody who, you know, really gets a good shot. Maybe an ayin tov is somebody who really can figure out another person. But there's a step further. An ayin tov means nedivus. So we have to try to figure out what is it about seeing good, seeing well, that allows us, that not just allows us, but necessitates that I have to actually give to you. So in order to understand this, we have to try to figure out what is the bigger picture that we're seeing here. What is the big picture? What's the thing that we're missing that we only understand with iyum? And the answer is that when I look at another individual, not only do I realize that what you have is not shayach to me, not only do I realize that what I have is exactly what I need, but there's a deeper picture. And the deeper picture is this, that actually you and I are fundamentally connected. And my success is actually wrapped up and intrinsically a part of your success, and vice versa. That when you succeed, it actually makes me better off. What's that saying that, you know, all the tide rises all boats? Something like that. No maritime individuals here, right? The tide rises all boats. Now, I'll give you an interesting example. I have a friend of mine who lives in the United States. He was complaining one day. He says, I don't understand why I have to pay so many taxes that go towards public schools, because in the United States, they don't give any funding to religious schools. He says, I send my kids to Jewish schools. I don't use the public schools. Why are so many of my tax dollars going to public schools? And a third friend of ours said, I pay taxes to public schools because I want to live in a society where access to school is available to everyone. Because that makes my society better. If I know that everybody here in the entire country has access to school, I guarantee you that's going to lower the crime rate, it's going to overall boost the economy,
eventually it comes back to me. This isn't a zero-sum game where when you win, I lose. It's a positive-sum game, as they say in economics. And what that means is that when you succeed, when you come up with a technological innovation, that actually improves me financially. It makes us all better off. It makes us all wealthier. Now, the same is true al pi ruchnius, in a ruchani sense. If you get a good pshat, even if you're the one who gets the kavod for it, that helps me. That improves my life. That brings more Torah to the world. Now, what is it like? What happens when there's a person who doesn't exhibit that, who looks at the opposite, who has a tsaras ayin, an ayin ra? Well, what that does is, it does a few things. Number one, it prevents the amount of overall Torah being learned. But that's not just neutral. That's not just preventing the good from happening. It's actually creating the bad. I have a very terrifying mushel. There's an illness that describes what happens when a certain organ of the body no longer responds to the other organs of the body and begins growing rapidly despite the fact that it's actually harming the other parts of the body. That's called cancer. When one part of the body ignores the rest of the ecosystem of the rest of the limbs and says, it doesn't matter what you do, I'm looking out for myself, that doesn't just prevent the other limbs from doing well, it's actually destroying the entire body. And if we think about it like that, then when we look at the students of Rebbe Akiva, it starts to make a lot more sense what was going on. Rebbe Akiva's students, who represented the totality of the next generation of Torah learning, who weren't sharing their Torah with each other, it was as if it was an entire body whose organs and limbs stopped communicating with each other. The reason why they died is because they were killing themselves. Quite literally, killing themselves. When the flow, when the shefa is not being brought down to the world through a shleimus of Torah, it's not just that individuals suffer, it's the entire klal. And the reason for that is because klal Yisrael accepted the Torah as a klal. That's the din of Arevus. That's why when you haven't done the mitzvah of Kiddush, I haven't done the mitzvah of Kiddush. And that's why I can say Kiddush two or three times a night when I have my students coming in after work, you know, 7, 7.15, 7.30. And it's not a bracha levatala. The Maharal says that the reason why we need at least 10 men to say Inyanei Kedusha is because Kedusha means understanding the totality of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. You think you can do that alone? No. The only way you can realize that we can in some sense touch the Kedusha of a Kadosh Baruch Hu is when we're in a klal. And 10 is the microcosm of a klal. We're now in the Sphira, and we are counting up. And if we want to give it an extra dimension to what it means to count up, it's this. It's that each day that we got closer to Kabbalah Satorah, it was not a separate day, but it was cumulative. And that was a hachana more than anything for how we accept the Torah. Because the Torah itself is cumulative. It's the reason why I can look at one sugi and I won't understand it until I've learned the rest of Shas. And it's a little bit of a stira minei ubei. But I can't understand Shas until I've learned Shas. Because every single sugi in Shas is connected to the every other sugi in Shas. And if that's true of Torah as a whole, then that's also true of the Jewish people. Because Kudsha Berichu Yisrael, the Torah Chabu. And if that's true, then that means that if I don't understand Shas, and if you don't understand Shas, then together we don't understand it. Only once you've understood it, and I've understood it, and everybody in the base medrash has understood it, then we can be able to finally come to a Havana. And that's where the Gemara says, Ein Torah Niknis Ela B'Chabura, We need to come together as a chabur to be able to learn Torah. So we are here during the Sfira. We are noheg not to cut our beards. We're noheg not to go into frivolity because we're being asked to look deeper. Look beyond my face. Look beyond the well-kept appearance of who I am. There's an iyun that has to be done with other individuals and with myself. And that iyun is that it's not you against me. It's not a zero-sum game where your success means my decline. It's exactly the opposite. Ayin Tov means that I see the interconnectedness of all of Klal Yisrael. And that's the refuah. That's the refuah to the Makkah. Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim died because they didn't realize that Torah Echas and Klal Yisrael Echa were all one. And so my success depends on your success. So when I'm holding out the good pshat from you, then that means that I'm only hurting myself and I'm hurting the rest of Klal Yisrael. We should all be Zocha together as a Klal, to recognize who we are as a Klal, to be able to understand that our success depends and is vital and is essential and integral. And it's not just it's not just happenstance, and it's not just a nice pshat, it's not just a nice midah, but it's something that we all have to try to understand is absolutely vital for the continuity of the Jewish people. Thank you very much.
I don't know if the base amounts going to